WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Colorectal cancer is one of the most common types of cancer in the U.S. for both men and women. The American Cancer Society estimates that this year alone, over 150,000 people will be diagnosed with the disease, and cases are on the rise for people under the age of 50. Those younger folks are often diagnosed with more advanced stages of the cancer due to delays in detection. Younger folks like Mandy Wilk. Her story began when she was 34 years old. 8 years and multiple organ transplants later, the 42-year-old is now cancer-free. We'll hear from Mandy in a moment, but first, we talked with one of her physicians. Dr. Catherine Myers is a lung transplant pulmonologist at the Northwestern Medicine Canning Thoracic Institute. I started by asking her, what's the connection between lung transplants and colorectal cancer?
The most common site of cancer metastasis, or that is cancer going to another organ, is the lungs. Your entire blood volume goes through your lungs every day, multiple times a day, in order to get oxygen, right, from the environment. And so we see that colon cancer, breast cancer, almost every cancer you can think of can and will often go to the lungs if it's left to time. And so in Mandy's case, she did eventually develop colon cancer in her lungs, and that's sort of how I got involved as a pulmonologist. Mm.
Yeah, according to Johns Hopkins Medicine, lung cancer patients, they're usually not eligible for lung transplants. Is that right?
Correct.
Why?
So whenever we transplant patients, we are trying to make sure that they can live as long as possible after the surgery. And so generally, if you have any life-limiting illnesses, you are not considered for transplant. But additionally, transplant patients receive a lot of immunosuppression. Immunosuppression can actually cause cancers to grow more quickly because your immune system can't fight the cancer. And so one of the reasons cancer patients are often not candidates for transplant is because of that immunosuppression and the risk of recurrence.
Mm. We've been hearing that people are getting cancer younger. That's something that we've reported on the show recently as well. But why do so many young people get overlooked when it comes to detecting their cancers?
So because it's not the classic patient population, and oftentimes many of our screening algorithms do not include younger patients. So colorectal cancer screening, for example, doesn't start usually until earliest 45, depending upon family history. And so patients in their 30s and 40s oftentimes are not receiving regular colonoscopies in order to rule out these low-grade early cancers, which is one of the number one factors in decreasing colorectal cancer cases and deaths in this country. So because they're not part of that screening algorithm, oftentimes the cases can be missed until they're very advanced.
Yeah, I mentioned that earlier. They're often diagnosed with more advanced stages of cancer. So we're going to bring in Mandy here in just a moment. She was a part of Northwestern's Double Lung Replacement and Multidisciplinary Care, or DREAM, program. Talk about the need for a program like this, doctor.
So as you said, right now, many lung cancer patients and cancer patients in general are not candidates for lung transplant and often other organ transplants. And so this registry is a patient registry where we're actually looking at transplant in this specific patient population. Because some of our hesitancy in transplanting these patients is theoretical. And so we don't really know how patients might do after transplant mm-hmm. in some of these cases. And so we're looking at patients with select types and stages of lung cancer, but also patients who have other types of cancer, such as Mandy's case, colorectal cancer, that have spread to the lung, and trying to see if this is a viable treatment option when other courses of therapy and standard chemo and surgery have failed.
That's Dr. Catherine Myers, who's one of Mandy Wilk's doctors and lung transplant pulmonologist at the Northwestern Medicine Canning Thoracic Institute. Thank you so much for that breakdown.
Of course. Thank you.
I want to bring Mandy into the conversation. Hey, Mandy, thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you for having me.
So Mandy Wilk is a survivor of colorectal cancer and recipient of a life-saving double lung transplant surgery. My goodness.
Amazing.
Amazing. Right? We'll get into your incredible story. It begins in 2017. I wonder how everything was leading up to your diagnosis, because I understand this kind of came out of nowhere.
For me, it came out of nowhere, for sure. Prior to the diagnosis, I was completely active. I'm a long-distance runner, so I was running miles and miles a day, led a really healthy lifestyle, working full-time. And one day, we had spaghetti for dinner, I remember, and I got really sick, and I thought, oh, I have like food poisoning. And a couple of days later, I still felt these like sharp pains in my abdomen. And so that led to me going to urgent care, being seen by my regular physician, ultimately having a CT scan and then a colonoscopy.
Mm. You go to emergency care, you meet with doctors, you get a CT scan. I mean, so how long did that take?
So up until the colonoscopy, I would say that probably took about a month and a half. And when the doctor suggested that I have a colonoscopy, because I was so young, I was 34 at the time, he said, you know, we'll schedule that in about 3 months. It's about a 3 month wait to get you in. And I just had this really kind of sick feeling in my stomach that said, like, you shouldn't wait that long. Mm. So I had said, you know, if you can't get me in sooner, then I'll find somewhere else to go. And then magically appointment became available within like maybe a week or two. And that's after having that colonoscopy, the doctor quite literally came into the room and said, I never saw this coming. Mm. And that's how I found out that I had stage four cancer.
What was going through your mind at that point?
I was thinking, like, first of all, if I hadn't advocated for myself to have this colonoscopy 2 months before they said I should, what would have happened? And then I was just really shocked, because I was so healthy and I had zero inclination that anything was wrong.
I'm thinking of the words stage four cancer. When you hear that in your 30s, what are you thinking? Because I know what we all think when we hear stage four cancer.
Right. So I was thinking, and it's probably one of the stages of denial, but I was just thinking, like, I will find a way to fix this.
Yeah.
Like, I will find a way out of this. Everything started happening really fast once they diagnosed me.
It was like,
we're going to start treatment and you know, everything's going to change. And so
chemo starts. That's the next step.
The next step was once insurance approval happens for all of that treatment, it was chemotherapy right away. Yes.
How many rounds?
So initially, I think we ended up doing like 15 to 17 rounds, which is...
Wow.
Typically, they do 12. The doctor that I had gone with, his theory was, we're going to treat you until you really can't take it anymore, which was a detriment because it ended up hurting my liver more than it should have. But,
and do they mean just because chemo is so tough on the body, from what I hear?
Yes. It was.
So till you physically could not take it anymore.
Well, it was more like my body couldn't take it anymore. Like, my blood counts were really low. And so when they're doing testing to see how things are going, they're adjusting medications based on like the blood work that they receive. And so after a certain point, my body couldn't take any more chemo. I was still functioning. Like, I'm this whole time working full time and like I have a life going, right?
Really?
But my body could not take it anymore.
Working full time in what field?
So I work as a curriculum. At that time I was a teacher, but I'm a curriculum and instruction specialist in Bloomington.
All through these 15, 16 rounds?
All through the last 7 years, yeah.
And they tell you have 2 to 2.5 years to live, Mandy.
My first oncologist told me that, yes. So that my first meeting prior to any chemotherapy was with an oncologist and a liver surgeon. And the oncologist said the prognosis is about 2, 2.5 years, and you should just continue life and, you know, enjoy it. So take more vacations, do the things you want to do, because although we're going to treat you and we're going to use the regimen that I was on was called 5-FU. So it's a very strong treatment of drugs.
Okay.
Although we're going to give you like all we have, like realistically you are stage 4 cancer. Like there's going to be a limited amount of time, you're terminal.
Still, you are thinking what you told us earlier. You are optimistic and you're saying to yourself, I'm going to figure this out.
Yeah, I think it was just determined. Like I'm determined to figure it out. And I know that maybe is not realistic when you're given a diagnosis like that initially, but I just felt like I will figure it out. And just because I'm getting one prognosis from one doctor, I know that you can have a second
Let
opinion
me get a second
or a
opinion.
Third opinion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What made you ultimately come to that decision to seek a different oncologist?
So I wasn't okay with the mindset that we're going to treat you with these 12 rounds and then that's kind of the whole plan. And so even before treatment, I moved to a different oncologist. And that oncologist, also their facility worked with multiple hospitals, and so they had access to other clinical trials. So I just wanted to make sure that the net was spread wide for any opportunity so that I was given the best shot.
Mm-hmm. In 2020, you eventually get a liver transplant at UChicago. Your brother Adam donated 60% of his liver, but it wasn't as easy as just making an appointment. So talk about what it took to even get this transplant.
So as I'm going through chemotherapy the first time, those first like 12 to 15 rounds, I had gone to multiple other hospitals across the country asking about a liver transplant. And I was told that at multiple hospitals that that wasn't an option. That's not something at that time that people were doing, with the exception of one hospital in the United States. And so I also went to that particular hospital in the United States to meet with that doctor. He wanted to wait till I was a little bit further along and kind of exhausted all opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
I did come across a doctor in Houston that said, hey, I have some friends at UChicago that are thinking of piloting this program and they're about to start. I'm originally from the suburbs of Chicago. Mm-hmm. And so this was like kind of, I don't know, serendipitous that it just kind of worked out this way. So she gave me the contacts for the doctors at UChicago, and I reached out to them and I said,
your chance to come back home for treatment.
Yeah, I need help. And I heard that you were thinking of starting this program, and I am going to be your best fit. Like, I am going to do everything I can to make sure that I am successful and your program is successful.
How do you feel after the liver transplant?
So the liver transplant happened during the height of COVID. That was really challenging.
Okay.
My brother, I have two brothers. I called them up. I said, I need a transplant and they're considering me and I'm going to need a live donor. And both of my brothers, without any hesitation, were like, when do I start testing? Where do I sign up? Like without any hesitation. So I feel really lucky that I have two brothers that just love me so much. So Adam, because he still lives in the suburbs here, we went with him, and the transplant ended up happening on June 17th of 2020. He was doing great, like right afterwards. So that was what I was most concerned about, was his health. And like, I'm already terminally ill and I'm the one putting him at risk. So I was really worried about him.
Wow.
He did really, really well. It was challenging because nobody could come to the surgery. Like, family and friends could not come. We could not have any visitors in the hospital. So that was, I think, the hardest part for us. But after surgery, the recovery, like, I had some complications, but beyond that, recovered really well.
6 months later, they find dots
Yes.
all over your lungs.
Yes. Yeah, so I think it might have been the first CT that they did after surgery. It was about 6 months afterwards. And my pulmonologist called and said, you know, we found these mets all over your lungs, and they're not just like in one lung, they're in both of them. And so a lobectomy is not going to be possible where they take out just part of a lung, or they take out one entire lung, because they're all over.
So the dots, just so I'm clear, like what did that mean? What was that on your lungs?
So the dots or the mets are like little spots or little tumors that are going to be growing, and okay. They were all over. They did end up doing a biopsy of my lungs to verify that that's what that was, what they were looking at. And, mm-hmm. and it did come back as it was part of the colorectal cancer that had spread to my lungs.
So even after all those rounds of chemotherapy, the tumors on your lungs continue to grow.
Correct.
So what were your options at that point?
So then we did 12 more rounds of chemotherapy. And then I was placed after that onto a maintenance chemo, which was a pill. I was on that maintenance chemo for a longer period of time until some of my CT scans showed that that maintenance pill was no longer working effectively and the tumors were growing more rapidly. And then I went through another, I believe, 11 rounds of chemo.
And this is where Northwestern's DREAM program that we talked about comes in. Right.
So my doctors at the University of Chicago had been monitoring me this entire time while I'm receiving chemotherapy in Minneapolis. And Dr. Pillai called me and she said, our tumor board has been reviewing your case. And we think that you would be a really great fit and candidate as a patient for the DREAM program at Northwestern, which I had not yet heard about. And so she said, you know, I think you should reach out to them and just kind of get your name there and get your all of your scans, your information so that they can review everything to see if first of all, you are a candidate.
Yeah. Was there underneath all that uncertainty a sense of relief maybe on your part? Or was it still
I was
just
really
confusion
like,
and...
I was like, I'm being saved twice, really. Like I was given an amazing opportunity for a life-saving liver transplant. And now when I'm being told like, we don't, you know, these tumors in January, I was told of this year, these tumors are getting bigger and the chemo is not working anymore. So we can't use that. And the maintenance therapies are not working anymore. So we can't use that. We don't have any other options. This was really amazing that I was getting to hear like, potentially you could be a candidate for this transplant.
Incredible. Your brother started a foundation in your name and has raised thousands of dollars for art therapy at Lurie Children's Hospital. Why is this important to you?
So Adam, my brother, who is my transplant donor, he came to me and said, I would really like to start a foundation. Initially, he wanted to raise money for cancer research. And then we thought about how my entire career has been in education, and that's something that I'm really passionate about. When I was as a reading interventionist, I had a student who was also receiving cancer therapies, and he was missing a lot of school, and so I was his reading intervention teacher. And I just remember thinking when I was working with him, I got to have like such a fun childhood.
Yeah.
I got to go on vacations and go to parties and, you know, celebrate all the things without anything to worry about. And I would see him like missing lots of school and he was tired often. And I just thought it would be great to raise money for kids that were receiving cancer therapy and give them really positive experiences and fun experiences while they're in the hospital receiving those therapies. Mm-hmm. And so that's, the foundation's called Mandy's Foundation, and it raises money for Lurie's Children's Hospital to provide positive experiences for children while they're hospitalized.
So after everything, you, my dear, you never stopped fighting. You never stopped advocating for yourself. We talk about this all the time on Reset, but you know, many patients, they carry the weight of making doctors listen to them and taking their health concerns seriously, because this really can be a very lonely journey. And we also have to acknowledge that, you know, your case might be a little bit different. Not everyone has the resources to travel to different hospitals around the country, right?
Right.
Dr. Myers said that you made medical history. What impact do you hope your story has?
Well, first, I want to make sure that people know about the DREAM program because it is really a one-of-a-kind program right now in the United States that is helping people that otherwise don't have another option. And so what the doctors at Northwestern are doing is really groundbreaking, and I want to spread that word. I think it's also important for people to know that they can advocate for themselves. And unfortunately, right now, in the way things are set up, is advocating for yourself is probably the best option.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, there are other
so groups, getting those second groups, and third opinions, right?
Yeah, there are other groups that will advocate on your behalf, or like programs that can advocate on your behalf. But I've always thought that like I am most important to me, and so I'm really proud of myself for making a lot of this happen and having the determination. And I think when people are sometimes told no, they take that as like the end all be all answer. And if I had done that, I wouldn't be here. And so exploring all options and just being determined and self-advocacy is really important.
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you. Me too.
So glad you're here. You haven't had to go through any more cancer treatment since your double lung transplant back in June. Is that right?
Correct. No.
How does that feel?
You know, it feels a little surreal, to be honest. For the last 7 years, I've always been kind of wondering what's going to happen next, what treatment, what program. And so I'm really hopeful that I will stay cancer-free. And I'm trying to get into the mindset of this is my new life and what opportunities are available to me now that I'm healthy.
Speaking of opportunities, I hear you are getting back into running.
Yes.
Incredible.
I love to run. Prior to being sick, I ran all the time, and it was a huge stress reliever for me. And so when you are receiving chemo, you don't have the energy to do that. And at a period where I'm most stressed out, I couldn't do the thing that I really loved the most. And so I'm really just beyond happy to be able to run again.
Look at that.
Yeah.
We've been talking to Mandy Wilk, who's a survivor of colorectal cancer and recipient of a life-saving double lung transplant surgery. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you for having me.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Micah Yasin and edited by Meha Ahmed. It was mixed by Ari Mejia. Reset brings context to breaking news. If you're interested in hearing more, you can check out our entire catalog at wbez.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We'll meet again soon.
Love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.